Museum, and unlike the rest of you, I did not use my time especially well. So what I've got is not the fully realized paper that would be a fitting tribute to Steve, as if any paper I would write could be, but just some notes on a topic that Steve first introduced me to. The first paper of Steve's that I ever read was his Journal of Philosophy paper called Identity, Essence, and Indiscernibility, which is, among other things, a rousing defense of the view that I'm going to call modal profile plenitude. That's roughly speaking the view that the statue and the clay are only the beginning. When you've got the statue and the clay, you've got two objects that are coincident with one another in exactly the same categorical state, as Steve puts it, which differ only in their modal and other properties that correlate with modal properties. That's two objects. Modal profile plenitude is the view that that thing happens whenever it can. Given any modal profile compatible with the categorical features of a given object, there exists an object coincident with the original that has that modal profile. It's like this in this world, and as the modal profile specifies, in the various other worlds in which it exists. And those modal profiles don't have to correspond to anything familiar to us, anything that we would recognize as the modal profile of a real object. They're the relatively familiar ones, like the modal profile of a statue or the modal profile of a lump of clay. And then there are the exotic ones that we don't notice until philosophy calls their existence to our attention. As Steve sometimes puts the view, it's the view that every trans-world airline, spelled like that, Kaplan's term, corresponds to an object. That's a pun whose time has come and gone. There used to be an error. Anyway, this view that every modal profile is realized is not irresistible, but hard to resist as soon as you've taken that first step and acknowledged that the statue is one thing and the lump of clay a different thing. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the view might be formulated, and then I want to explore its implications for, of all things, ethics. That's the plan. So I find the view crystal clear. I know exactly what the friend of plenitude is saying. The view is actually hard to articulate in perfectly hygienic terms. I think it's easy to articulate if you spot yourself the notion of a categorical property. So I'm just going to say a little bit about what's meant by a categorical property. I have lots of stuff about how this notion might be refined and ultimately defined, but it's not very good, and I'm not going to go through it in detail because that's not the main issue. But let me just remind you what some of the issues are. Categorical properties are initially introduced to us as the properties that coincident objects like the statue and the lump of clay share, in virtue of being coincident. So they're properties like shape and color and location, as distinct from modal properties, like the property of being such as to possibly survive certain kinds of changes. Sortal properties, like the property of being a statue. Identity-involving properties, like the property of being this very statue. That's obviously a property with respect to which the statue and the lump of clay differ. Those are non-categorical properties. The categorical properties are at least initially given to us as the properties that these guys share. That's not ultimately a satisfactory characterization of the notion of a categorical property, but it clues you into the kind of thing we have in mind. A categorical state is just a maximal consistent categorical property. A categorical property that is consistent in the sense that something could possibly have it, and maximal in the sense that for any other categorical property, if you're in the categorical state, it's entailed that you either have or lack that categorical property. So your categorical state now is the strongest categorical property you instantiate. A modal profile, as I'm going to use the term here, is a partial function from possible worlds to instantiated categorical states. So the function takes a world as input and gives you a categorical state that's instantiated by something at that world as output. So for example, there's a function that outputs your categorical state in W at any world in which Joe Biden is the winner of the 2020 presidential election, but no categorical state in any other world. So if that modal profile corresponds to an object, there's a thing in your shoes right now that's categorically like you at every moment of your existence, would have been categorically like you if you had worn a different hat today or something like that, but which would not have existed if Biden hadn't won the 2020 election. So that's not a familiar sort of thing, but modal profile plenitude is the view that every well-defined modal profile in that sense corresponds to an object, that one included. So if modal profile plenitude is true, there is an object in your shoes right now whose very existence was at stake in the 2020 election. And not just one of them, lots of them. I'm not going to say very much at all about why we should accept this view. We can come back to that. It's an interesting question. There's more than one reason, none of them dispositive. So if you think the view is ridiculous, especially when you see what it forces you to say, we can talk about what grounds there might be for taking the view seriously. I want to say a little bit about how it might be formulated, and then we'll talk about its implications. The hard notion is the notion of a categorical property. As I first characterized it, it's the sort of property that you and everything coincident with you must share, if you possess it at all. But that's not quite right. So take the property of being 10 feet from a statue, or the property of being coincident with a statue. That's a property that you and everything coincident with you is going to share, or lack. But intuitively, it's funny to have intuitions about a technical notion, but intuitively, that property of being 10 feet from a statue is modally entangled in a way that precludes its being a categorical property. The categorical properties are supposed to be silent on how things stand modally. That property isn't. So this isn't an adequate definition. You could fix it up. You could say a property is categorical if and only if it's necessarily shared among coincidents, and its definition involves only properties that satisfy that condition. So this is an invocation of a little bit of hyperintentional apparatus, the idea that properties have definitions, and it might be useful in this context. The property of being 10 feet from a statue is a property that's necessarily shared among coincident objects, but intuitively, the definition of that property involves the notion of a statue. And the property of being a statue is not invariably shared among coincidents. So this would at least exclude that counterexample, and something like this might be made to work. But even if it could be made to draw the line in the right place, it's not the kind of definition that I would be looking for the following reason. If that draws the line in the right place, it only does so on the assumption that modal profile plenitude is true. But suppose you're a monist. You're one of these people who thinks there's only one object in a given place. So, for example, the sort of monist who thinks that in the vicinity of any given material object, the only thing there is a quantity of matter that survives over time and in other worlds so long as that quantity of matter remains intact. So this is a view on which there are no statues, strictly speaking. If a statue is something that cannot survive certain changes in shape, you have instead only statuesque hunks of matter that cease to be statues when you squash them, but don't cease to be when you squash them. That's an intelligible sort of view. It always comes up when you present the statue and the clay problem to undergraduates. That's the view they want when they want there to be only one object in a place. If you accept that view, then the definition will tell you that every property is a categorical property. But I'm thinking that the monist and the pluralist can agree in classifying, for example, red as a categorical property, but the property of being a statue or the property of being possibly green as a non-categorical property, even though they disagree in their metaphysics on this point. And I think it's a desideratum that an account of the categorical, non-categorical distinction should track whatever these guys are tracking when they agree, of course. Whether a thing is red or not depends just on how it is. Whether a thing is possibly green depends on how it might have been. So that's not going to count as a categorical property. They're getting at something, and this definition doesn't capture what it is they're both glomming onto. Here's the intuitive idea. What you want to say is, just as an intrinsic property is a property that you possess independently of what there is outside of you, so a categorical property is a property you possess independently of how things are at other worlds, independently of how things might have been. That's the intuitive idea, and the problem is to characterize the relevant notion of independence. It would be excellent if we could characterize the notion of a categorical property in this way, using only modal notions, possibly, necessarily, and so on. And that may be possible. There are complicated proposals along these lines, and there may be some that actually draw the line in the right place. But the most straightforward way of elaborating this proposal in purely modal terms doesn't work. Suppose, as might be the case, that everything that's red is also possibly green. A natural view to have before you get worried about this kind of metaphysics. On this view, whether you're red is not independent of how things stand in other worlds, if by independent you mean modally independent. Because if you're red, then as a matter of necessity, you're also possibly green, so there are other possible worlds in which you are green. And what I don't know is a good intuitive trick for filtering out these bad implications. The fact that red entails possibly green can't make red non-categorical in the intended sense. So here's the thought that I would like to elaborate more carefully. The fact that X is red may have implications for how things stand in other worlds, but it doesn't obtain in virtue of how things stand in other worlds. What makes you red is not that you're possibly green, even though being red entails that you're possibly green. Maybe it does. So the categorical features may not be modally independent of how things stand elsewhere in other worlds, but they should be explanatorily independent of how things stand in other worlds. So this gets closer, it seems, to the idea that everyone is tracking when they agree that possibly green is not a categorical property, but red, maybe. A property is categorical even only if and only if, for all possible objects, if X is F or not F in a given world, that's so wholly in virtue of how things stand with the objects in that world. That in virtue of means grounds, or is grounded by the way. So this is the claim that the categorical properties are grounded in the features that you, in the properties and relations that connect you only to your worldmates, but not to things in other worlds. Whereas the fact that you're possibly green, that, if we're speaking in these terms, obtains in virtue of the fact that you have a counterpart in some other possible world who's green. So that's a property that fails this test. Possession of it is not grounded exclusively in how things stand with you and your worldmates, whereas red, for all we've said, might pass this test. That's the right idea, but this way of putting it in terms of you and your worldmates and so on, that assumes modal realism. It would be excellent to be more ecumenical. And what I have on the next couple of slides is a way of doing that. I'm not going to try to say this carefully because it's actually not essential for what we're going to say. The idea is, when we were speaking like modal realists a second ago, we had this property, the property of having a counterpart in another world that's green. And when that kind of thing grounds being F, F is not categorical. That was one theoretical account of how this kind of modal feature can be grounded. According to the modal realist, facts about how you possibly are but are in fact not, facts about the properties you could have had but don't, Those are grounded in facts about your otherworldly counterparts. But that's not the only theory about how these de re modal facts get grounded. Everyone needs some account of what makes it the case that you could have been green in worlds in which you're not. Call those facts whatever they are, the premodal facts. These are the facts that make it the case that you're possibly F in worlds in which you aren't. The idea is that what unifies the categorical properties is that in every world in which you have a given categorical property, the grounds for your having that property are not premodal. The grounds for your having that property don't ground anything about how you are in other worlds, don't ground anything about how you could have been but aren't. So that's the more ecumenical way of saying that when it comes to categorical properties, you possess them in virtue of how things are here and not in virtue of how things are in other worlds. Okay, so that's, I'm sure that can be done better and I'm sure it's wrong anyway, but that's as far as I got with this. I now want to generalize a little bit. So far I've been talking as if things were simply coincident or not in a given world. I talked about your categorical state in this world, in that world, and so on. But that's not actually how we usually talk in this domain. The usual notion of a categorical property or a categorical state allows things to be coincident at some times but not others. So the ship of Theseus can be coincident with one collection of planks now and a different collection of planks later. So what we really need is the notion of a categorical property that you can have at a world and a time, different properties at different times in the same world. So the general notion is F is a categorical property if and only if, necessarily, if X is either F or not F, at a given world and time, this is so independently of how things stand at other worlds and times. So what makes you have the categorical features you have now are things that are wholly in place now, not facts about how you might have been but aren't, not facts about how you will be but aren't, not facts about how you were but aren't, but just facts about how you are in every sense here and now. So that's the more general notion of a categorical property. And given this, we have the notion of a momentary categorical state, the strongest categorical property you have at a given time in a given world. And then we have a notion which is a little more general than the thing I put on the table earlier, the notion of a modal temporal profile. A modal temporal profile is a function that takes world-time pairs as input and spits out a categorical state instantiated at that world at that time. Given that notion, we have a view that is stronger than modal plenitude as I defined it earlier. This is the thing that I'll call modal temporal plenitude, MTP. This is the view that every modal temporal profile is realized. This is probably what lots of people who believed in plenitude had in mind to begin with, but it's a slightly stronger view. So the view we had on the table before, modal profile plenitude, that yields a thing that coincides with you if Biden wins, but which doesn't exist otherwise. But that view by itself doesn't yield a thing that coincides with you before the election and carries on with you if Biden wins, but evaporates if Biden loses. That thing wasn't forced on us by modal profile plenitude all by itself. Modal temporal profile plenitude, sorry, the terminology is so ugly. Modal temporal plenitude yields this fragile thing, a temporary thing which coincides with you for a while and then cuts out if Biden loses. It also yields things that are even stranger than that, a thing that coincides with you forever if Biden wins, but which coincides with you until the election if Biden loses, and then coincides with me. One thing I want to say about this view, I said earlier that this kind of plenitude, once you see the case for the distinction of the statue and the clay, it's hard to resist. It is hard to resist, I think, given certain philosophical proclivities. It's also completely incredible, almost literally unbelievable. And that's one of the things that I hope will come out in the discussion. This modal temporal plenitude that I just described, it's equivalent to the original view, modal profile plenitude, given orthodox four-dimensionalism. That is the kind of four-dimensionalism according to which every filled region of space-time corresponds to an object that it persists by perduring. Everything, every material object is a four-dimensional worm, and every four-dimensional worm corresponding to an arbitrary filled region of space-time exists. If you're that kind of four-dimensionalist, then you don't get anything new when you go add modal temporal plenitude that you wouldn't have gotten just by adding modal profile plenitude. But if you're not that kind of four-dimensionalist, then this modal temporal plenitude forces on you all of the things that you might have hoped to do without. So suppose you think that objects persist through time by being wholly present at every instant when they're present. So they're like these little nuggets that are wholly there at every moment at which the thing exists. One of those things will still have a modal temporal profile that gives its categorical state at each moment at which it exists. That view by itself doesn't give you short-lived things, truncated things, things that jump around in space-time all by itself. But if you add modal temporal plenitude to that sort of view, you get all of those things back. All of the unwanted gunk that's there in an ontology like David Lewis's is forced upon you by plenitude, even given what might have seemed to be a more sensible, more economical starting point. So I'm going to talk about modal temporal plenitude from now on. And the main feature of it that raises the questions I want to discuss is this. Suppose I sneeze at noon. Modal temporal plenitude yields an object coincident with you that vanishes when I sneeze, but which would have lived a long and happy life if I had not sneezed. That thing exists, if this view is true. So modal temporal plenitude implies that my sneeze is lethal, in the sense that it is the but-for cause of the annihilation of a thing that was rather like a living, breathing human being before I sneezed. And it's worse. Suppose you're always happy, but Fred is always miserable. Fred could be halfway around the world. There's a modal temporal profile that returns your categorical state at all times if I don't sneeze, but yours before T and Fred's afterwards if I do sneeze. Orthodox four-dimensionalism gave us an object that was coincident with you before the sneeze and coincident with miserable Fred afterwards, just spliced together, you before the sneeze and Fred afterwards. That thing exists according to a Lewis-style four-dimensionalist ontology. What this modal temporal plenitude adds is that not only does that scattered thing exist, there's a thing which becomes miserable when I sneeze because I sneezed, which wouldn't have become miserable if I hadn't sneezed. So it imposes, it adds objects whose fates are causally sensitive to everything we do in radically disturbing ways. Or what seem to be, what you might think are radically disturbing ways. All right, suppose the oracle of philosophy tells us this is true. These things really exist. It implies that everything we do has surprising, sometimes wonderful, sometimes lethal consequences for the lives of things that are, at least in many respects, rather like us. Normally, if you do something that affects the fate of a person or something rather like a person, that raises ethical issues. Does the fact that everything we do affects the fate of these hitherto unnoticed entities have any implications at all for ordinary ethics? And this is a question that my colleague Mark Johnston has been pushing in various ways. He's quite sure that the answer to that question is yes. As soon as you acknowledge these things or any of the other odd inhabitants of the material world that various ontologies force upon us unbidden, as soon as you acknowledge that the empirical world is cluttered with things rather like us that are affected in surprising ways by the things we do, all of ethics goes to hell. That's Johnston's thesis, from which he concludes that we're not parts of the material world or something like that. I'm going to argue, or argue is the wrong word, I'm going to assert to the contrary. In fact, this kind of metaphysics makes no difference for ethics. The challenge is to understand how that could possibly be true, given that we are, in some sense, harming things rather like us all the time by everything we do. So I'm going to discuss two sorts of issues in ethics. One set of issues concern the ethics of harming and benefiting mere conscious subjects. If the only things whose lives were at stake were clams or lobsters, these questions would arise, assuming that clams and lobsters are conscious subjects, even if they are not in any sense beyond that moral agents or moral subjects at all. So there's the ethics of harms and benefits at this truly elemental level. That's one set of issues. And then there are the issues that arise when we think about the consequences of our actions for full-blooded moral subjects like us, whatever that means. So let's talk about the ethics of harms and benefits first. Fido's a happy dog, Fred is a miserable parrot. If you give Fido a bone, Fido's going to get a little happier, and no other animal is going to be affected anywhere. If you do nothing with the bone, if you just sit on it, nothing at all is going to happen to Fido or any other animal. I go out on a limb and say, in this case, you should give the dog a bone. That's what you should do. This should be the easiest possible case in the easiest part of ethics. And the worries that come from metaphysics are going to be not that they force us to give the wrong answers to ethical questions. The worry is always going to be of the form, the metaphysics threatens to make easy cases incredibly hard. And that's a bad result. This should be the easiest case. It's a Pareto improvement for the only thing that matters in the picture, the animals that might get more or less happy as a result of our actions. But now consider Charlie. Charlie's coincident with Fido, and then with Fred, the miserable parrot, if you toss the bone, but he's always coincident with Fido if you do nothing. And Fido's happy enough to begin with. So tossing the bone is good for Fido, but very bad for Charlie. It's going to make him a miserable parrot, or coincident with a miserable parrot. So the metaphysics makes this easy case hard. And it's going to get infinitely worse when we consider the infinitely many things that are harmed and benefited in other ways by your act and all the alternatives. I said, keeping the bone to yourself does nothing. Well, it doesn't do nothing if there's a thing whose modal profile is such that it's going to stay coincident with Fido if you do nothing, but jump to Fred if you give the dog a bone. So you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You're going to immiserate something, no matter what you do, infinitely many things. And you're also going to make infinitely many things happier if you do nothing. No matter what you do, the case is infinitely complicated. It may be that all of these things somehow cancel out, and we're left at the end of the day with the view that you should give the dog a bone anyway, despite the unspeakable harm you cause to infinitely many conscious things. But that would make this a tragic choice. The best of your awful options is to give the dog a bone, whereas this is not a tragic choice. So there must be some story about why it's not a tragic choice. This problem, as I formulated it, only arises if this thing that's coincident with Fido until I toss the bone, then coincident with the miserable parrot, is itself a conscious thing. We know that Fido is conscious and that the parrot is conscious. I stipulated all of that. But we don't know yet that everything coincident with a conscious subject is itself a conscious subject. That is, in a way, a substantive claim. It would follow almost immediately if your conscious state were an intrinsic state. But it probably isn't, for reasons independently of this. This is, I think, a familiar argument now. Consider Theon and Dion. These are going to be perfect human twins, except that Theon has no left foot. Theon is conscious. Theon is a duplicate, an intrinsic duplicate of this undetached part of Dion, Dion minus his left foot. But it's at any rate not at all obvious that this undetached person part is a conscious subject. It's part of a conscious subject, but it doesn't follow from the fact that you're part of a conscious subject, that you are yourself conscious. I don't think your head is conscious. Even though your head has a brain in it, which is doing whatever your brain is doing, because it is your brain, but it's not, it would be anyway too quick to go from the fact that your brain or your head is part of a conscious thing to the conclusion that your brain is another conscious subject, much smaller than you in roughly your vicinity. So I don't think consciousness is obviously an intrinsic property of the things that have it. So it doesn't follow from the fact that this scattered thing, Charlie, initially coincident with Fido, later coincident with Fred, it's intrinsically like a conscious thing at every moment of its existence. It doesn't follow from that that it is itself a conscious thing. But suppose it is. I had hoped in this paper to have some argument to the effect that these things should be regarded as conscious. Consciousness turned out to be harder than I thought it was, so I don't have an argument for that conclusion. But suppose this thing is conscious. It's bad enough from the point of view of ethics if it might be. Because in ethics, in order to decide what you should do, what matters is the probable or possible consequences of your actions. If it's a real possibility that everything you do immiserates some conscious subject because of this bizarre mechanism, then that's something that ought to have an impact on how you ought to act. But I'm going to insist on the claim that even after we've come to take this metaphysics a little bit seriously, if you open up your eyes and look around and consider a real choice situation, it is just obvious that the fact that by snapping my fingers I would make a bunch of these things jump from okay to miserable is no kind of reason at all not to snap my fingers. How could that be? That's the question that I would like to have an answer to. And the answer has to be this. In this part of ethics, where we're talking about the goods and bads that attach to states of affairs in virtue of the experiences of conscious subjects, like clams or lobsters or whatever it is, in this part of ethics, all that matters is the distribution. The distribution specifies which conscious states are realized at a time, over time, at various regions of space, and which conscious states would be realized if we did this, if we did that. The moral rule, I assert, that governs harms and benefits in this part of ethics, I don't know what it is, but it tells you what you should do on the basis of considering how the various options open to you would affect the distribution of experiential goods and bads. And adding this metaphysics of plenitude to the picture changes nothing at all relative to our common sense starting point in our thought about how the experiential goods and bads will play out over time and over modal space if we do this or if we do that. So that's, I'm going to suggest, got to be at least a large part of the solution here. If these guys are conscious or might be conscious, then their individual fates, conditional on our actions, don't matter at all. Because in general, harms and benefits to individuals don't matter in this part of ethics. All that matters is the way our conduct affects or might affect the distribution of experiential goods and bads. That's just dogmatic assertion. That's no kind of argument at all. But it's not an uncongenial view. It's consistent with any view you might hold about how those experiential goods and bads impact how you ought to act. doesn't apply anything like total utilitarianism or anything like that. Every more subtle view is consistent with this picture, and the idea that this metaphysics couldn't make a moral difference at that level is reflected in the fact that all that matters is the distribution of experiential goods and bads conditional on your various actions. You can't say that when we get to the next and more interesting part of ethics. This is the stuff that I really want to talk about because I find it was surprising to me to have some of these thoughts as I was talking. Look, say what you will about clams and lobsters and parrots. Some things have a distinctive, exalted moral status that protects them from being treated in certain ways, even to promote the good, even to promote their own good. If I can improve the distribution of experiential goods and bads by pulling Fido's rotten tooth, I should do that. If I can improve the distribution of experiential good and bads by pulling your tooth, I need your permission. I've got to be able to look you in the eyes and justify my conduct to you for it to be morally unproblematic. The hardest questions in ethics concern this exalted moral status. What does it take to have it? Lower animals don't. Most normal human beings do. What is it about us that gives us this kind of exalted moral status? And what follows from having it? I gestured vaguely in the idea that you're protected against certain forms of treatment by the fact that you have it. Exactly how does that work? What is the moral content of possessing this kind of exalted moral status? That's the $64,000 question in non-consequentialist moral philosophy, it seems to me. I'm going to say almost nothing about this, except that most human beings have what it takes to possess this distinctive moral status, and it has the kinds of moral consequences we normally think it does. You can't impose massive costs on the thing with this kind of moral status for the sake of trivial benefits to others, for example. Even lots of others. So here's the example. You come to me for a nose job. I'm a plastic surgeon. I'm very good at nose jobs. I explain the surgery to you. You sign a consent form, and we go ahead. No other person or animal is affected, so by normal standards, I'm in the clear. This should be the easiest case, or at least a very easy case, in this part of ethics. I'm going to benefit you. You gave your informed consent to what would otherwise be an impermissible imposition of harm, but because you gave your informed consent, I'm in the clear. And here's the problem. Let Larry be a fellow traveler, that is a person-like thing who's going to coincide with you for a while, whom the surgery will consign to misery. It's going to be coincident with you until the surgery, and then with a miserable parrot afterwards, but if I don't do anything, he stays coincident with you. If my act would harm another person in this way, it would be wrong. People have a right against being harmed for benefits to others. Because notice, Larry's not going to benefit from the excellent nose I provide you with. Because I do the surgery and he's going to be off miserable somewhere else. So I'm imposing costs on him, the interference that's involved in the surgery, for the sake of a benefit that's going to accrue to someone else. And normally it's wrong to do that to a person. So why am I not wronging Larry every time I do anything to you, even if I have your consent? In these kinds of cases, we can't say only the distribution matters. It's part of having this kind of exalted moral status that I need to be able to justify my conduct to all those affected who have the relevant kind of moral status on terms that they cannot reasonably reject. And if this bit of surgery is going to make Larry utterly miserable for the rest of his life, he has a complaint against my doing it that I need to be able to address in order for my conduct to be morally unproblematic. But obviously this question doesn't arise. This easy case is easy. For some reason, not yet explained, we do not have to justify our conduct to Larry in the same way in which we do have to justify our conduct to normal human beings. But why not? I'm skipping some stuff, but we can reconstruct later. Why not? You can't say that what makes you a creature with the relevant exalted moral status is that you're a human being or you're a person. It's not brute kind membership that makes you the moral citadel that you are. It's your capacities. It's something about what you can do. Your capacities for reflection, emotion, thought, feeling, action. The kinds of capacities that distinguish you from other lower animals that don't have this exalted moral status. And the problem is that at least some of your fellow travelers look to be like you in respect of all of the relevant capacities, because they're configured just as you are, and many of them have most of the same modal properties that you have. Most of them have the same dispositions you have, or at least most of the same dispositions you have, most of the same powers that you have. And your capacities, your morally relevant capacities, if they are determined by your categorical and modal features over long intervals of your existence, then your fellow travelers should have the same relevant capacities that you have, and if they have the same relevant capacities, they should have the same moral status. So their objections to the courses of action that I might propose to myself should have the same weight as mine would, or as yours would. That's the worry, because they clearly don't. I've gone on a little too long. I'm going to just tell you what my answer to this question is. This was the stuff that I most want to talk about, so let me at least get it on the table. I don't know what the grounds for moral status involve, but I'm going to assume something pretty minimal. They involve the capacity for action, goal-directed action. This can't be sufficient because animals can do this, but it's a necessary condition, or so I'm going to assume for now. And I'm going to argue that these fellow travelers, despite their being similar to you in so many respects, are not agents. They never act. The reason they don't act is that action requires certain elemental psychological capacities, the capacity to combine desires with means and beliefs to produce intentions. These mental states are all essentially de se, insofar as they're practical, such as to lead to action. I may desire that Rosen have a cookie, de dicto, de re, but that desire can only lead me to act if I think that my walking across the room to the cookie jar will get a cookie for Rosen, and then come to want, de se, that I walk across the room, to intend that I walk across the room as a result. You can't do any of the things that feed into the elementary story of intentional action unless you're a subject of de se thought. It'd be great to have a theory of de se thought. Don't have one, don't need one. That's all we need. And now the crucial claim is, these oddball entities in your shoes are incapable of de se thought. They may be capable of thought. So when you think, I want a cookie, there may be an episode in the life of each of your coincident fellow travelers that registers in the same way, both phenomenologically and semantically. They house a thought. In fact, they house the very same thought you house. Just as you and your fellow travelers have the same head, you and your fellow travelers think the same thoughts if they think at all. But the I you token when you think, I want a cookie, refers to you and not to them. So the I that they token when they think, I want a cookie, refers to you and not to them. There's some argument for that. The argument is, this is certainly how it works with third personal reference to persons. If I use a pronoun to pick out Jill, or I use Jill's name to pick out Jill, I say, Jill is going to the store, or Jill will be in Paris next week. There are plenty of things coincident with Jill now that won't be in Paris next week, because they're going to cut off or they're going to switch to someplace else. But it's not as if what I say when I say Jill will be in Paris next week is somehow indeterminate in truth value, because I'm talking about lots of things at once, some of whom will be in Paris, some of whom won't. That's not how it works at all. Somehow or other, by the miracles of reference, magnetism, or whatever constitutes them, third personal pronouns, she, proper names like Jill, manage to glom onto people, and not to almost all of the things that are coincident with people. I say the same thing goes for the first person pronoun and for the element of thought in Desai thought that corresponds to the first person pronoun. And if that's right, if there's only one episode and it's relevantly unambiguous, charity or something like it forces us to say that whenever these pronouns are tokened, they refer to the whole person, a well, modally and temporally well-behaved person, and not to any of the other things that are coincident with these guys. And that means that when the fellow travelers house these Desai thoughts, they're thinking about you. They never think about themselves in the effortless, easy way that you manage all the time. And because they can't think about themselves in that way, they aren't agents. And because they're not agents or anything like agents, they're very strange. They go through their whole lives completely oblivious to their own existence. Unless they take a metaphysics class and somehow discover, as they couldn't otherwise have known, by description, that there's a thing corresponding to them. They are so bizarre. I said before that they're so much like people. Why aren't they? They're not much like people at all, because so much that's morally relevant about people involves this capacity for Desai thought. They utterly lack it. And so it's no mystery at all that they make no moral difference. Or they don't make the kind of moral difference that people make. So that's a way of saying that this metaphysics, which may be well supported by arguments internal to metaphysics, should leave everything as it is when it comes to this part of ethics. And if that's true, that's good news. Metaphysics can change things at the margins, but if metaphysics overturned our moral lives, that would be a reason to wonder about metaphysics. No reason like that in this case. I'll stop.
Thank you.